This is file number 1, cycle 4. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is October 31st, 2018. I am interviewing Leo Gaffney. He's going to talk about St. Mary's Church, the Syrian immigrant family that live in the area, the Salisbury Housing Trust, the school board, and anything else he wants to talk about. But first, we're going to start with the really difficult stuff. What is your name?
Leo Gaffney.
And how did you come to the area, Mr. Gaffney?
Well, some years ago, before we were married, Judy and I looked at the area and purchased the home as a vacation home. But then with some changes and an opportunity to work from home, we moved up full-time in 1988, which was the time we were just starting a family.
Oh, wonderful. So you really didn't have knowledge of the area before you came up. Didn't you say you came up to a conference at the Interlaken?
That's right. Well, I worked at McGraw-Hill at the time, and we had several sort of middle management conferences mm-hmm. at the Interlaken. So that's how I became familiar with the area.
And you moved up here in 88?
Full-time. We bought the house in 84.
Okay. And we're going to start with St. Mary's Church. Explain to me the difference between St. Mary's and St. Martin of Tours, please.
Well, within the last year or two, there's been a reorganization in the Hartford Archdiocese, and some churches were put together under a new parish, and that's what happened here. So St. Martin of Tours is the parish, and there are three churches, St. Mary's in Lakeville, St. Joseph's in Canaan, and Immaculate Conception in Norfolk.
Okay. And you have a new priest.
With one priest. We have a new priest, just came a few months ago, Father Driscoll.
Father Driscoll.
Dawson.
Thank you.
David Dawson.
What is RCIA, please?
The RCIA is the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults, which I directed off and on for about 20 years. I say off and on. Some years we had adults who wanted to enter the Catholic Church, and some years there weren't. I was a Jesuit priest, so I had a background in theology and spirituality, and Father O'Brien, who was the pastor when we first moved up, asked me to do that, and I enjoyed that. And also for, 8 years or so, Judy and I directed the religious education program for children.
Ah, yes. Catechism.
Yes.
Right. when you were doing it, was it at St. Mary's Wednesday afternoons, or was it another time in another place? Do you remember?
The children's program was on Sunday.
Okay.
Between the masses. In those days, we had a mass at 8 and another one at 10:15. The children's religious education was in between masses.
Okay. Were you on the parish council?
You know, we've had a parish council not very often in the last 30 years. When we did, I'm reaching back, no, I was not on the parish council, but I was on the planning committee for the church hall renovation, and also on a committee, another committee for kind of parish renewal, stewardship it was called. And I was on a committee coordinating the development or starting of the new parish, which met quite frequently during the 6 months or so of Father Ian's. He was the first pastor of the new parish, St. Martin of Tours, and he left a few months ago to become a Benedictine monk.
Ah, out in New Mexico, you said.
Yes. Abbey of Oro, Christ in the Desert.
And Did Father Kernath come between Father O'Brien and Father Ian?
No. After Father O'Brien was Father Kelly. He was here for maybe about 5 years. Then Father Kernath for about 10, and then Father Ian for a year and a half, I'm not sure, and then a few more.
And then now David Dawson.
That's right.
And so that would be 2018. Now, how did St. Mary's get involved with the Syrian family resettlement?
Well, it was in the spring of 2016. Sean White, a parishioner and friend of mine, was looking for an opportunity with the Syrian and other immigrants coming into the country, refugees, for a group at the parish, or initially from the parish, to do something. And looking around, he then came in touch and contact with a group called IRIS, which is sponsored by the Episcopal Church. I think it stands for International Refugee and Immigrant Services. So he and I went down there for a couple of hours once. Again, as I said, it's fairly early spring 2016. We learned about it, and they have a very workable model, which includes a number of areas: housing, transportation, English, work, medicine, and so on. And so it seemed very workable. They were a little wary about sponsoring us because of the distance. Most of their what they call co-sponsor groups are in New Haven or close to it. But they finally agreed, and we brought a group of 8 or 10 down for a full day of training later that spring or early summer, and that in that they explained this model. And we moved along with that, and then we're very fortunate to have a house offered at a very good rent possibility, and we told them about it, and they we said it's a good size house and we could take a reasonable size family.
It's a man and a woman and 7 children.
Now. Right. When they came, so we were told about the family, and we had some discussion wondering whether we were up to that larger family. There were 6 children and one on the way, and we decided that we would. And so when they told us about the family, by their model and planning, we had 2 days, 48 hours, to let them know if we were agreeable to it. So we were. And the family arrived on August 30th of 2016. And were taken to the house, and which they didn't realize it was a place that where they would live. The next day they were told that. It was very nicely furnished by the Episcopal Church in Lime Rock. Heidi Truax got a group together, and they were ready to start. So as I say, the housing, well, I don't think I'll have to read that. The housing, Wendy Hamilton, a local person, provided the house at a very reasonable rent. So the areas in which we were concerned, English as a second language, of course, was first. None of the family spoke any English. They had been in Jordan for about a year and a half to 2 years, I believe. They had left Aleppo before that and told the story about having been about an hour away, and the father wanted to go back. They were told that bombing would take place near where they were, and when they went back to have a look, their house had been destroyed. So then they were in Jordan for a couple of years, and then with all of the vetting, I guess somehow or other, came to the top of the list. And we've also been told the story that when the father, Mahmoud, was told, they were asked if they wanted to go to the United States, he thought it was some sort of a joke. At any rate, they were very pleased to be here and settled in very nicely. ESL worked very well for the children especially, and the elementary school has been very, very welcoming, had extra help in ESL and tutoring, and the children have made friends and settled in there now, of course, more than 2 years here. Medical was another area they needed shots and physicals and all of that. And, of course, the mother was well along in her pregnancy she delivered in November of 2016, making the seventh. Maya, who is their little American native born. I had volunteered to cover the transportation, which was one of the areas, and it was a big job. I obviously didn't do it all myself. I had a team of people I could call on, but it gave me a good opportunity to meet them, which I did, and I worked with Mahmoud in driving. He could drive. He had been driving for, 15 or 20 years in Syria, but he had to learn enough English to pass the test. He failed it a number of times and then passed it. And a couple of very generous donors through the parish, through Father Ian, I believe, made it possible for them to buy a van. And that, of course, gave them the kind of freedom that they needed for shopping, for going to the lake, and so on. They all seemed to be healthy. The oldest girl had Lyme disease, but other than that, a few little things, they've done well. They got their green cards, I believe it was October 2017, so over a year, and that was a bit of a celebration.
Oh,
also,
sure.
Their permanent green cards. Mahmoud worked initially at a restaurant and then went to the Harney Tea, local tea company. They've been very good to him, and he's a hard worker and gets good reviews from them. He's still there. There was another worker right practically across the street who drove him until he got his license, and now he drives. Social services has been very helpful with what's available in regard to other funding and emergency situations like big bills at the dentist and the food stamps, which are very helpful.
Who's Mr. Mulligan's first name?
Joe. And Patrice McGrath, the local social service person, has been very helpful. We've had a Arabic Lebanese speaker who has been both friend and interpreter along the well, several actually. Bayat Chase, who's in lives in Kent, was helpful, and Zaina Mahio, who lives nearby.
And spell her name, please.
Yeah. Zeina.
Wait a minute. Zeina.
Yeah, Mehio.
Mehio. Is it all one word?
No.
Via.
Zaina Mehio.
Z.
Yeah.
Zeina.
Yeah.
And Mehio. Mehia.
I think so.
Okay.
So, Ira sponsored us, not legally, but with a signed agreement for a year, and we've been gradually, trying to have the family be more self-sufficient, and I think we're going nicely in that direction.
Are there plans in the parish to sponsor another immigrant family?
We've talked about it, and it's far more than a parish. I should mention that. It started with the parish, but the group now is still a few from St. Mary's, a number of very energetic people from the Congregational Church, and they have been generous with funding at certain times when it was needed, and location. There was a kind of a supper to benefit them last year. They helped cook it, Syrian food, and that was at the Congregational Church Hall. And a lot of people who are not affiliated with any church. So the group is quite, it's Salisbury more than St. Mary's, but we're still pleased that St. Mary's was able to initiate it. But I'd say we don't have any, ongoing plans for another family.
But you've been very successful with this one, which is an accolade. It truly is.
Thank you. Well, we feel good about it. As with so many things, it certainly works both ways. It's been very, very rewarding. The kids are wonderful. The parents are really nice people. They've taken advantage. There was, at the end of that supper, as I mentioned, and also at a recent little supper at their house, the kids ended singing God Bless America.
Oh, how wonderful.
Not a dry eye in the house. Yeah, it was very nice. And they've been in school plays and participating mm-hmm. in sports, soccer and basketball.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very, very much for that. Now I would like to go back to the Housing Trust, if I may. Who started the Housing Trust?
The Housing Trust is initiated after something called the Salisbury Forum in the year 2000, and housing rose to the top as a very significant need. And 7 or 8 people, the leader among them was Richard Dunham, and they formed the Housing Trust, and after a couple of years it was incorporated as a 501 C3, and fundraising began. I joined, I think, in 2004, been on ever since. I've been the chair for, I guess, about 10 years. And so we've always been working at raising money, looking for sites or houses, and applicants.
And what was the purpose?
Well, the purpose was to provide homes for people who couldn't afford homes in the house, in the area, but either through their family history or work were part of the community, and also to have houses that would be deed restricted, which is important to the state and the town going forward. That it's not just a lower cost house, but one that will remain that way. So we sign an agreement, a contract with the owners, that restricts the sale price to the consumer price index over time. And the Housing Trust retains ownership of the land. The people own the house, and they can do what they want with it, as with any other homeowner, but they need approval from the Housing Trust for any substantial renovations that might add value to the house. So it's gone well. We now have 13 homes owned and occupied, and one more that's close to, it should be completed within a few months.
And how many locations do you have?
We're at five locations.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Dunham Drive has how many houses?
Dunham Drive has 8, 4 renovations of older homes and 5 new modular homes.
Well,
they were new when they were built, yeah.
That, is it 8 or is it 9? Because...
That's 9, another...
That's
9. 8.
Okay, there, so it's 3 that were renovated and 5 are modular?
Yeah.
Okay. And on Indian Cave?
Indian Cave is a duplex.
And Indian Mountain?
Indian Mountain is a home.
And Lincoln City?
Yeah, one home.
And is there one on Route 41? If you've got 13 houses, then
There's one on Lincoln City Road, up from the school. Did you mention that?
Yes, but if you...
Indian Mountain.
Indian Mountain, Indian Cave, Lincoln City... That would be 1, 2, 3, 4, and 8 is 12. Where's the 13th?
There's one other single home.
And I thought you said it was Route 112, Route 41.
Oh, 41, I'm sorry. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, up from the White Hart across from the cemetery.
And your funding is all private donation?
We had two small grants from the town for certain situations, $10,000 each. The rest was raised.
But you don't get anything from the Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I would say some comes from family foundations that are under the umbrella of the Berkshire Taconic.
But not specifically?
No.
Okay.
I don't think they do funding themselves, but maybe they do.
And you said that there are three basic areas: funding houses, purchasing land, and getting applicants?
Well, no, funding houses or land, that would be one. I would consider that one area. Another is seeking funding, the other is applicants.
And who is eligible?
We look primarily for people who live and or work in Salisbury area, and it's income restricted. It follows more or less the HUD guidelines, but since we don't take public money, we can show some flexibility. But it's always people that can't quite manage a mortgage without help. Very often there's a significant difference, especially now. Mortgages are very tight, and there's a difference, you know, between... People might be able to afford a mortgage at $190,000, but not at $220,000. So we either lower the mortgage by subsidizing the house, or we fix up the house as needed with repairs or adding a bathroom or something like that.
Do you have a list of applicants that are waiting?
We have a few, not a long list. That's been... it's moved more slowly than any of us would have imagined. We thought people would see it as an opportunity, but it seems a lot of people don't quite see themselves as homeowners, or maybe we haven't gotten the word out quite enough. But for whatever reason, I mean, we've had enough, and we always have some. Mm-hmm. When we have homes or land on which we can build, we get applicants much more readily, and we're hoping that the town acquisition of the Pope property, which is quite a few acres, that a portion of that will be dedicated to the housing trust, and then I'm sure we'll get more applicants. The problem without having that is that we are looking at houses that we might renovate, but we can't afford to buy them without an applicant. And then if we have an applicant, we need to have a house that they like, they're buying the house, and that we can afford, and that we might have to fix up a bit, and that we'll get down to the right price. So there are a lot of variables in it, and it takes a lot of juggling. Whereas if we have land and can build a house, not exactly to specifications, but within the range of an applicant, it works much more easily.
And your modular homes are less expensive to build than a stick-built.
By a lot. Yeah,
okay.
A whole lot.
Is there a screening process for the applicants?
Oh, yeah. We check their finances. We interview them. And we have references and so on. So it's pretty standard.
Yep. Okay. Now, if they purchase the house, and they live in it for a while, and then they decide that they want to sell the house, do they have to give you first refusal?
Yes.
Okay.
We have our first refusal, and we have to approve the applicant, because the applicant has to fit the needs of, you know, affordable housing. They couldn't sell it to somebody as a weekend home.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So their applicants need to be approved by the housing trust.
Wonderful. All right, let's backtrack to the school board.
Yes.
You were on the school board when?
Did I give you the dates the last time we spoke?
You said 1992 to about 2003.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
That's about right. 12 years, 2004, I guess. Yeah, 2003. Yeah, yeah.
And how many
election.
Years?
So 12 years. I was chair for six, as I recall.
How did you get on the school board? Were you asked or did you volunteer?
Well, I have a background in education. I was a school principal a long time ago myself and a teacher. And so as I got to know people, I was asked. I didn't really volunteer, but I was happy to be asked.
And over the time that you were on the board, what were some of the changes?
Well, just before I went on, they had done a major new building and renovation, and or I'm trying to remember.
That was the renovation and, of the lower building, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that provided for a separation of the middle school students. That gave that a little more identity there. I think the K-8 was very beneficial to kids. You know, there's been a lot of movement toward middle school in this country, but I think the K-8 worked well. We still had changes. They went to individual classes and all for the middle school. It was self-contained in the earlier grades. As a board, it's more oversight and policy. The teaching and administration is up to the teachers and the principal. So our main thing was to approve and support and provide the budgets, work with the finance committee sometimes. And they were always very good. They would never tell us what to do educationally, but some years they'd say, you have to lower the budget by such and such, and we never argued with that. We just did it. We would then decide, where to make the cuts.
Did you have a principal search while you were on the board?
We had one. When Tom Bradley resigned, we had an extensive search. It was pretty much led by the superintendent, but we had board members and community members on the search.
Do you remember when Tom Bradley retired? No, I don't either. I know it was after I left.
Yeah.
And you said that at the time that you were on the board, the negotiations separated between the elementary schools and the high school. No,
well,
they separated the towns.
Yeah,
they all
as you know,
separate.
We have six regions. Each one is its own region, and they all feed into the high school regional program takes care of special education and the high school and a few other services, and each town takes care of its own elementary school, and it works quite well. But then one year with, there'd be negotiations every 2, 3, 4 years, usually 4 years, depending on the previous agreement for contracts, and it got quite prolonged and a little bit tense 1 year, and then one the districts settled on their own, and then they all did, and so we've been separate ever since. And it's a bit of an extra burden and expense.
Yeah.
And
it
so,
is.
But that's the way it's been.
Were there any controversies over curriculum changes?
I don't remember anything big. I remember once there was an issue over Spanish. It was a bit of a backtracking at the 7th or 8th grade, and we had a good board meeting. Everything was very polite, and a few parents came in and spoke about wanting, a bit more, and that was the way it ended up. And now I think there's a little bit of Spanish, a few hours a week, maybe in some of the lower grades. I'm not sure when it starts. But we did have a major curriculum, now that you mentioned, effort, because math became something controversial. And so we hired a retired superintendent. He was an outstanding superintendent from a outstanding district, Farmington, and he led what he called participatory evaluation. It was only about six meetings, but it was what happened between the meetings that made the difference, and the way he led it. We broke up into committees. We outlined 30 or 40 questions and then broke them into different categories and then went out and did our homework, some of which was what are the better school districts doing with regard to math, and what happens with remediation and enrichment and so on. materials. And so we came up, one thing we discovered was that the better school districts, who were more successful in math, were spending an hour on math, and we were not, so that went in. Time is very important. Educational people say time on task. Well, it's fairly obvious if a kid spends more time, they're likely to do better. So that was a big improvement, I think, in the math curriculum.
Do you have a math specialist or someone that teaches math to the different levels? Or does everybody do their own thing?
Well, that's a good question. At the middle school level, it is one person who's better qualified and certified in math. At the lower levels, certification is not required by subject, so the homeroom teacher teaches all the subjects, and there are some questions about that. A lot of elementary school teachers, for whatever reason, are not crazy about math. They're good in English, and they'd rather do that. So I think there are still issues. One thing I was very happy to see was how well the Syrian children are learning phonics, so they're still teaching it at Salisbury, and teaching it looks to me like very well.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And you wrote several books, some of them from your career and some of them related to your religion. Would you talk a little bit about your book, Never Stop Praying?
Well, the most recent one, Never Stop Praying, I guess grew in part from my work with the RCIA, and I've been active with the men's Bible group, which is interdenominational, interfaith, meets at the Congregational Church. It's mostly members of the Congregational Church, and we've been meeting 4 years. Every time we talk about how long, nobody seems to know, but it's certainly more than 20. I'd say closer to 25. I wasn't in on the beginning, but I've been active on it. So mm-hmm. I had a number of different, and my own life, I suppose. So this book fits in with the current interest in meditation and mindfulness and things like that, also with age-old practices within the church. And the publisher came up with the title. I didn't, but I'm happy with it. And also a subtitle, Mini Retreats. And I think that's apt also. I suggest, I don't know how many people use it this way, but I suggest that one might take an incident, a situation, like the first one is accept or acceptance. And it's perhaps a bit countercultural, but the saints and mystics always seem to come up with this as the most important thing, accepting God into their lives, also accepting what comes into our lives, that we don't have to go out and prove something every day. And maybe the hardest thing, accepting, is to accept ourselves. So, yeah, that's that book. And it's doing, selling pretty well. Just speaking with some people active at a Catholic college, and they're hoping to use it for student discussions to read 3 or 4 sections and then get together every month or so and talk about it.
Wonderful. A teaching tool. Terrific.
Yeah,
terrific.
That's right.
Now, you did a second book on peer leadership?
Yeah, well, that goes back about 10 years. I spent a lot of years, I've been working for about 30 years, I guess, as an educational evaluator. Funds, grants always require an external evaluator. And one project I worked on for a number of years is in science and math called peer-led team learning. It's a small group learning led by a student who has taken the course before that and is guided in how to help a small group of 8 students. And it's a little more complicated than it sounds. The leaders have to be trained, they need special materials, the instructor really has to be involved if it's going to work well. So we developed a model of 6 what we call the critical components. Business people sometimes call them success factors, but it's rather similar. And then I got a small grant to write a book about it, what you'd call a professional book. It's published by Springer.
What are the 6 critical components then.
You're going to ask me now.
Yeah.
I'll just mention a couple. The what we call organizational arrangements are, and that's the size of the group, the location, the time. That's all one, the organizational arrangements. And, you know, I used to do site visits, and whenever things weren't working right, it was because one of these components was not in place. That the professor be involved, that sounds obvious, but there were places where the professor teaching the course would turn it over to somebody else. Materials are critical, made to fit with the course and small group learning. There were places where the students, a connection with the course is critical. So that would be the fourth. There were places where they were doing sort of enrichment things which didn't help the students in their tests. So, let's see now. Well, that's four.
Well, you've done four?
Yeah.
Well, that, you know, I'm not going to test you on this
yeah,
one.
Yeah, no, I didn't bring it along, and I haven't looked at it in a while.
That, but, you know, that gives a very good summary.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to add to this interview before we close?
No, thank you. No, I think you're doing a good job. I think having some oral record of the town is very helpful. By and large, we've had a very good town government, and on the school board, other boards that I've served on, in-town issues, things rarely broke down along political lines of political parties, which, you know, at this time it might be important to mention. It's not so obvious, but in town issues, budgets, policies, whatever, it was always just, you know, trying to do the right thing, and it made no difference what party one was.
It didn't make any difference. It was for the betterment of the community.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.